walk across the courtyard towards the library. I can hear the insects buzz and the leaves beneath my feet.
Happy February, Kodiak! You're listening to Dog-Eared Reads, Fetching Books and Tales by the Kodiak Public Library Association. I'm Athenia, host and producer of your show. We have a wonderful guest today on our show on the Beyond the Cover segment. Leanna Brooks is joining us. Leanna Brooks is the author of some sci-fi fantasy. She writes the Heroes and Villains series, including Even Villains Fall in Love, Even Villains Go to the Movies, and Even Villains Have Interns, as well as her Time and Shadows series. She's also written and published a number of short stories, as well as providing editing services. And she also raises her kids, so she has an awful lot going on. I'm glad James asks her how she manages to balance it all, so stay tuned to find out. Later on our show, Bob Ross is joining us again. Bob found a fantastic book in the young adult section called The Impossible Rescue: The True Story of an Amazing Arctic Adventure. This book details the successful 1897 rescue mission to save a whaling crew stranded in the Arctic waters. It's a fantastic story, so stick around for that. We also have Leanne Schmelzbach here doing a book review of the Giver series by Lois Lowry. So if you haven't read that series yet, you're going to want to stick around and find out why it's on our must-read shelf. And finally on our show today, we have our lively live chat segment where Katie Baxter, the director of the Kodiak Public Library, sits down with some friends to talk about computer safety, both at the library and on your home computers. It's quite an informative little segment you'll want to stick around and listen to. So all in all, it's a great show we have for you today. Before we get to the Leanna Brooks interview, though, I want to stop and take a moment to thank everybody that turned out for the Altered Book event night that we had on February 3rd over at the Gerald C. Wilson Auditorium. There was a great turnout. Thank you everybody that showed up to vote on your crowd favorites. We had some fantastic winners and really amazing art pieces. That art will be up for the whole month at the Kodiak High School front foyer in the display cases, so if you haven't gone to see it, please stop by and check it out. The artists did an amazing job this year, so if you go, you're guaranteed to see something you like. So thanks again, everybody, that supported the Kodiak Arts Council and the Kodiak Public Library Association this year with the Altered Book event season. We'll be doing it again next year, so get your ideas ready. Now, let's hear from Leanna Brooks and James Raines with their Beyond the Cover interview.
Makes us do the opposite of what's right for us.
Today on Dog-Eared Reads, we are going to have an interview with Leanna Brooks. Leanna Brooks was born in San Diego and has lived in Chicago, Denver, Florida, Kentucky, Texas, Georgia, Alabama, South Carolina, Kansas, and now Alaska. She has four kids, one husband, and one giant mastiff puppy who thinks she's a lap dog. She writes superhero romance, the Heroes and Villains series, and science fiction thrillers with Killers in the Time and Shadow series with HarperCollins. From your biography, we have seen that you've lived a lot of different places. What brought you to Alaska?
My husband's job brought me up here. It was not in my top 10 places to visit. I was born in San Diego. I really do love my warm weather, but we came up to Alaska for a job, and I love it up here. It's gorgeous in the summer and very enjoyable in the winter when the heater is working and I can stay inside.
So I saw that you lived in Chicago as well. I bet it's quite a bit of difference moving from even San Diego, for example, or Chicago to Alaska.
There's a difference. I've got to say the summers here in Alaska are the prettiest I've seen anywhere. I love hiking. I love being able to go out to Beluga Point because we're in Anchorage. You can go to Beluga Point, see the belugas on a regular basis. That's a lot of fun.
So you were raised in San Diego and...
Sort of, yeah.
Sort of?
Is that... I lived there, Chicago. I went to high school in Denver, so a little bit of everywhere.
What were some of the favorite things you liked to learn as a child?
I love to learn anything. I was big on science. I had a microscope when I was a little kid. I think I might still have it somewhere. I love art. I like talking to people about religion. I like listening to people. So if there is something to learn, I am more than happy to sit there and listen to you explain how to knit or how to dye or how to fish or how to survive in the woods, anything. I love learning everything.
Which authors inspired you in your youth?
I grew up reading J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis. Those were the first authors that I remember my parents reading their books to me. And I always tell the story that I took an illustrated copy of The Hobbit to kindergarten show and tell to show my friends because I had finished the book and I wanted to go play Lord of the Rings with them and chase the works. And my friends had no clue what I was talking about because it wasn't She-Ra or He-Man. So those are the authors I grew up with. And as I got older, I started branching out a little more. I read Anne McCaffrey, Louise McMaster-Joel, Terry Pratchett, Jim Butcher. I've got to say, Terry Pratchett probably made the largest influence on my life because I was able to see how he used humor and fantasy as social commentary. And I just love his writing. I love how he's able to cover so much while at the same time talking about dwarves and trolls.
Yeah. I love the titles you have for your heroes and villains series. Do you think that would be what you mean by, in a sense, using some humor in your books?
Yes, I tend to be a little more optimistic than other sci-fi writers. I think just as a trend, we tend to be very grim, dark, and looking to the dark and scary future. And I have a wicked sense of humor, and I love making a reader laugh. I think if you've done that, you've done something amazing with the book. And I do think we need humor because sometimes we get so wrapped up in these very dark, scary ideas, and then we introduce a little bit of humor, add a little bit of levity, and it lets everybody take a breath, step back, and see the bigger picture, and just breathe again. I'm not on Terry Pratchett's level. I can't even promise I'll ever be there, even if I write until I'm 99 and die. But I love his philosophy that you can take something that's not just contemporary focus and contemporary fiction and comment on contemporary issues with fantasy and science fiction.
So what made you decide to become a writer?
Actually, everything I knew I couldn't be a writer. Like some people are born with the whole idea that you can only do certain things and that you have limitations and whatever genes code for that in the human brain, I don't have them. So okay. The whole idea that I couldn't be a writer never occurred to me. I was just, there were books, people wrote books, I was a person, therefore I could write a book. And I started very young. When I lived in Chicago, they had the Young Authors Program.
Okay.
And so every year the kids in school were encouraged to write a book. So when I was in kindergarten, I wrote a little book about a sea turtle looking at pollution. And I colored the pictures and my mom helped me write the words. And in third grade, I wrote about some dwarves who were fighting wargs to get a baby's rattle back. And I won my third grade year or something like that and got to go to a conference with real authors. And so it was never an issue of you can't. It's just, do you want to?
So you've mentioned a lot about social issues just a little bit in the time that we've been talking in reference to your books. Is that one of the reasons why you write, to discuss social issues in a format that's acceptable by a wide audience?
I think there's some element of that. I wouldn't have said that a year or two ago when I first started publishing. That wasn't at the forefront of my brain.
Okay.
I am becoming more politically aware, especially in the past several years. I've met more activists. I've met more people who give me a broader view of the world. And I've appreciated that and learning from them. And I think it is becoming more of, you know, we need to have books for everybody. We need to have books that look at these issues from every angle. And we need to have books that really open up the discussion about what is humanity? What does it mean to be human? What does it mean to be a good person? What does it mean to stand up for what you believe is right, even when other people don't agree with you?
Why do you think originally you chose to write?
I had stories in my head. I used to scribble them down on the back of my math notes and pass them to my friend in geometry in high school because I was bored and I had a story idea. And so my notes were just filled with half-started stories. I finished my first novel, I think, in my sophomore year. I filled the whole notebook up with a story about a girl who's frozen by magic and wakes up 3,000 years later and went from an Iron Age society to a spaceship society and her coping with that fish out of water type of thing. You will never see that published. And I will deny it probably if you ask me about it. But that was my first novel. And it just kind of went from there. I read very, very fast. I can read your average 400-page novel in a couple of hours. And so I get to the store and I read all these books and they're sometimes not the story I'm looking for. And when I can't find that story on the shelf already, I'll go write it so that I can read it, so I can have it, and so other people who are looking for it can have it.
Talk a little bit about your books. What books are you best known for?
I think the Time in Shadow series, the one that starts with The Day Before, is probably my most widely published series, set in near future Alabama and Florida, and it follows the adventures of a bureau agent named Sam Rose, who thinks she's going to go solve a normal murder mystery and gets tied up in time travel and defending the future and dealing with clone rights and all these issues that I imagine might come up in the future if we get time travel, which would be fun. And that's the one that's the one that gets published the most and is most widely published. I do have, like you said, the Heroes and Villains series starts with Even Villains Fall in Love, and that does have a dedicated fan following. It was originally published with Breathless Press out of Canada, and they folded. They were a small press and folded about a year ago. That's not as widely published and easy to find anymore, but it does have a good little fan following.
Okay. I really love the cover you have on your website of The Day Before, and it kind of looks like your stereotypical morgue, but when you open it up, it looks like there's like this hyper tunnel going someplace. It's just a very unique and
the portal. Do not go play with that. Long time travel, it's a bad plan.
It seems like you write in a couple different genres here. So what genre do you enjoy writing the most in?
Overall, big umbrella, I like sci-fi. And I love science fiction because it's writing the future. It's creating a new idea and kind of scouting ahead for the rest of humanity almost. It's carving the trail. All the tech that you use today, all the inventions you see from TVs to smartphones to computers, those all popped up in a sci-fi premise first, whether it was on Star Trek or in Star Wars or in a book. All of this came from sci-fi first. And then somebody who read the book went, oh, I think I could build that, and went out and did it. So I think of all the genres, as much as people are like, oh, it's genre fiction, it's not that good, science fiction is really creating the future and kind of setting these goals. We had Star Trek that went and had the first interracial kiss and had a Russian on the helm with all these Americans and had a black woman taking a lead role. And then, you know, we had Dr. Crusher in The Next Generation, who was a female doctor, who was the chief medical officer, and all these changes. And now, you know, I grew up watching TNG, and now it's normal. See a lady at the doctor's office. Mm-hmm. You don't even think about it. But there was a time where seeing a woman as a doctor was weird. It was science fiction that normalized that and said, this is what we could be. We can be even better than we are now. We can have even better things. We can get along even better. You know, humanity has a bright future. Here's what I think it should be.
Do you write full-time or part-time?
If we're going full-time is 8 hours a day, I'm a full-time mom and a part-time author, which means I work about 4 hours a day on publishing related things, usually 2 to 3 hours of writing, and then an hour of paperwork, promotion, just the busy work of running a full-time career, I guess.
Do you have a special time that you write in your day, or like a structure, or do you just kind of write when you can write?
I try to write in the mornings or late at evening. That's when my brain is most focused, I guess, on imaginative stuff instead of, you know, the clinical paperwork stuff.
Okay.
But I've found that it's bad to get locked into a structure. And if you only have one time a day you can write, then any little upset throws that off. So I do steal moments where I can. I carry a folding keyboard with me. It hooks up to my phone via Bluetooth, and I'll sit down, open up my email app, and type a chapter in an email and email it to myself while I'm sitting there at my kids' volleyball practice or something. So authors can get very hooked up on the, oh, I shouldn't do this. The scene's not perfect in my head yet. Or, oh, I should go wash the forks, or little things. We're amazingly distracted little creatures sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
There's just so much going on in our heads. For me, it's usually more the mood. I have to, you know, there's the mood for the scene. Are they upset? Is this a happy scene? Whatever it is. And if somebody comes and distracts me, it can really throw off my mental tempo. I have learned, because I had very tight deadlines for the Time in Shadow series that came out with Harper Voyager's Impulse Line. And so I had 9 months to write the books and get them to my editor and get them from idea to published in 9 months. And I found that I couldn't let small things interrupt me. I couldn't let little things throw me or stress over a paragraph. If you write it and then you fix it in edit and you don't worry about it to edit, rough drafts are meant to be rough.
Now, we've kind of talked a little bit around this. Do you work on an outline, or do you just kind of prefer to sit down and see where the story takes you.
I do sometimes work on an outline for the contracted books because Convergence Point and Decoherence were sold on spec. I had to turn in an outline before I started writing them. My editor had to approve it. But that doesn't always work. And a lot of times I find myself just pantsing it and planning only a couple of chapters ahead, which is some writing advice that Bijolbe gave. She writes the whole Vorkosigan saga and all of that. I don't know if you've had a chance to read it. It's an older sci-fi series that I love. But she's like, just plan two or three chapters ahead. Worst case scenario, what's the worst thing that could happen to your character? Go write that and then figure out how they're going to survive it. Just be in some interesting predicaments sometimes because sometimes you have a character in a situation and I don't know exactly if I can get them all out alive. That's going to be fun, but it does make for a good book. I do, to some degree, have an outline. I try to find three villains and four plot twists for the book before I start writing. I find that if I can stay with those, then even if I get off track a little, I can come back to my plot twist and I can go branch off and explore more, but I'm following the original direction of the book and it keeps me from writing a boring book.
How do you think your writing has evolved creatively?
When I started writing my very first books back in high school and all of that, I was really kind of obsessed with creating a utopia. And all of my early books, I've got 7 or 8 novels stored on various hard drives and in notebooks and things that I wrote. They're all trying to find the perfect government, I think, where I was trying to work out what kind of laws would you have for this justice system and just kind of playing with the idea of government. And it wasn't until I wrote a book that didn't have an ideal government, but where the person, where the main character was taking responsibility for their choices and actions, that I really came out with a good book that was interesting and what I would consider a real book. And even though that one hasn't been published, that's where I changed from going, oh, we need a utopia and we need laws, to realizing that you can't codify perfection. You can't create utopias with laws. And perfect endings and happy lives, all of that comes from an individual making a choice and then choosing how they react to certain stimuli and circumstances outside their control.
Have you ever considered writing dystopian fiction then?
You know, a lot of people, when The Day Before came out, they're like, oh, it's dystopian, it's near future, there was a collapse of government. I'm like, not really. It could have been dystopian fiction, but it's the idea of rebuilding after chaos and major political upheavals. The Day Before is set not in the United States of America, but the Commonwealth of North America, which was Mexico, Canada, and the United States getting together after a major financial collapse and working together more in a union similar to the EU rather than as individual countries to rebuild. And the book does explore kind of the angst that comes with giving up your national identity and joining a larger nation and trying to integrate these different cultural ideas and histories together for a larger nation.
What do you think the hardest thing about writing is?
Self-doubt and making yourself sit down and do it even when you don't have a contract or deadline. I know a lot of authors, and I watch them, and I've watched their careers for years. And what kills a career and what kills a book is an author going, I'm not good enough, and giving up. You may not be perfect on your first book. You may not be perfect on your 10th book. But Jim Butcher wasn't good on his first book. I guarantee you, Jim Butcher wasn't Jim Butcher good on his first book. You get better with every book you write. And if you're willing to keep taking the lumps, taking the rejections, and trying, you can have a career in publishing. If you give up and say, I'm not good enough, I don't know if I'm good enough to write this scene, then you won't ever be published. So it's all whether or not you can get past your own insecurities and self-doubt to sit down and write and try.
Do you have any amusing marketing stories that have happened to you while attempting to market your book?
I hate marketing. My least favorite part of being an author. I think the worst/funniest thing that has happened is Even Villains Go to the Movies, my second Heroes and Villains book, small press. I sent it in to the editor. I was given a round of edits. They told me when my book was going to be published. I was getting ready to publicize it and everything. And I noticed I hadn't heard anything back from the editor or the cover artist or anybody for a while. And my release date was approaching. I was just getting really nervous. So about a week before the release date, I sent a letter to my editor and to the editor-in-chief of the press. And I'm like, hey, I haven't heard from the cover artist yet. Can I see the cover art before the release? And editor-in-chief of the press wrote me back. He goes, we let that editor go 2 months ago. She never forwarded any of your stuff. So we were a week before release date with nothing, and I have an amazing cover artist, and Justin was the editor, and he was amazing. We managed to pull it off, and we got the book out on time, and it was all okay in the end. But, you know, sometimes little things like that, somebody forgot to forward an email, it can really put you into crunch time. Horror stories more than anything else.
How much research do you do for your books?
Depends on the book. For the Heroes and Villains series, very little, because it's, you know, science, fantasy, superheroes, and supervillains. For the Time and Shadow series, I read peer-reviewed articles. I spent time taking, you know, Coursera online free physics classes, trying to understand quantum physics a little better. I did a ton of research to make it as accurate as time travel is ever going to be. It's probably never going to happen. It's a theory. It's a cute theory. I don't think it'll actually ever happen. But I wanted that to have a firm foundation in science and actually be something that I could be like, oh, yeah, this is the theories I use. This is the multi-world hypothesis. I've got pages and pages of notes. It was a fun experience. I enjoyed learning, but I think if you go back in my Twitter feed to that 2008, 2009, at some point I had tweeted, the worst thing about time travel is having to invent a time machine. That was a big clunker when I was writing the first draft of the book. I got, you know, 3/4 into the book. I'm like, oh, I actually have to know how this thing works for me to use it as a plot device.
So where can we find out more about you and your books?
I am online. My website is www.lianabrooks.com, which is LianaBrooks. I'm on Twitter as Liana Brooks. I am on Facebook as By Liana Brooks. I'm on Tumblr as Liana Brooks. I think the title of the Tumblr is All the Pretty Things. I have a newsletter. I have an Amazon author site. If there's any way you want to find me on the internet, just look for a pair of brightly colored socks. That's usually what I use as my avatar. On Twitter, it's a bright pair of rainbow colored socks against stars. I'm easy to find.
What do you think your favorite science fiction book is?
Oh, it's hard.
If you had to narrow it down to just one.
If I had to narrow it down to just one. Oh, can I have two?
Okay, two's great.
Senegonda by Louise McMaster Bijold, which has Miles Verkosikan going and saving the enemy empress. And The Price of the Stars by Deborah Doyle and I want to say James McDonald.
Okay.
It was one of the first sci-fi space operas that I read, and it's just big, sweeping cosmic tale of politics and aliens and fun stuff, and things go boom.
Okay. What is your favorite science fiction movie?
At the moment, I really like Star Trek Beyond. That was the last big one that I loved. Jurassic Park is up there. Star Trek Beyond was fun. That's the newest one where they killed the aliens with rock and roll. It was great.
Oh, yes. Okay.
I like how optimistic Star Trek can be sometimes. I love that it kind of looked at Kirk's depression and his fear of his own death and aging, and then just kind of went, you know what, this is life, we're just going to tackle it, balls to the wall, let's go, and we're going to do it, and we're going to do it smiling, and it was fantastic. Thank you so much for having me on. It was fun. I look forward to hearing the radio in February.
Thank you, Liana Brooks, and thank you, James Rains, for that fantastic interview. We always appreciate hearing from authors about how their daily lives are. And I've been interested in quantum physics lately, so I think I'm going to check out that Time and Shadows series, get a fun take on a heavy subject. For those of you looking to find out more information about Liana Brooks, you can check out her website, www.lianabrooks.com, spelled LianaBrooks.com. Now let's head into our Community Roar segment, where we rave over amazing reads. If any of you out there have read a good book and you want to share it with people of Kodiak on this radio program, I encourage you to contact me. You can reach me via the KPLA email address, that is kpla.alaska@gmail.com. So send me an email if you're interested in doing a book review, and we can arrange a time to meet at KMXT, and I can help you get set up with recording it here at the station. If you would rather do it at home, you can always do a book review on your own device and then send the WAV file to me over the email address, and I will get it on the radio program that way. I really encourage you, if you've read a good book, to share it with the other people in town. We always want to know what's good that's out there to read. Today on our show, Bob Ross is joining me, and he's got a book that he found in the young adult section of the library that details an amazing part of Alaska's history. And he makes a very good point that it's surprising we haven't heard more about this story. I myself traveled to St. John's, Newfoundland a number of years ago, and in Newfoundland they had a whaling expedition that was a fairly big tragedy, and they turned an entire museum in St. John's into a memorial for this whaling story. And this story that Bob Ross is about to tell you is something that's just as fascinating and museum-worthy as what happened in Newfoundland, but it has a much happier ending. And it's really surprising that we don't have a museum about it or even really know very much at all beyond what Bob is about to share with us from this incredible book. So let's hear from Bob Ross and his latest book review on the Community Roar segment.
Hello and welcome to another in the series of book reviews from the archives of the Kodiak Public Library, Alaska Room. Deviating just a bit, in this month's book review, it comes not actually from the Alaska Room, but it will soon be there. But it comes from the juvenile section of the library. The book's name, The Impossible Rescue, the true story of an amazing Arctic adventure by Martin W. Sandler. This 2012 softbound, easily read, and exceptionally well illustrated 163-page book is published by Candlewick Press of Somerville, Massachusetts. It is the successful rescue story of the Arctic whaling fleet trapped near Point Barrow in September of 1897. Now, they had felt that they had another 5 weeks of whaling time when cold weather came in and locked them in place. There were 8 boats that were trapped, 9 actually. The Alexander spent 18 hours both ramming forward and back and breaking a channel out to open water to escape the ice pack. It involved about 300 people trapped in the vicinity of Point Barrow. This is perhaps the greatest account that I have read of heroism, sacrifice, and endurance, both over land and sea, and it involves the revenue cutter, the Bear, and primarily 3 of its officers that formed what was later to be known as the Overland Relief Expedition. When the Alexander got back to its home port in San Francisco, they spread the word that the whaling fleet was trapped. Telegraph from San Francisco to Washington, D.C., alerted the president and his staff that there was potential for a mass starvation of the whaling fleet. They had provisions that would last them for a few months, but nowhere near what it would take to reach the spring thaw the following year. President William McKinley ordered the Bear to their rescue and relief. Captain Tuttle, in command of the Bear, was given full, carte blanche as to loading the Bear with supplies and to head off in relief, but he was to travel as far north as he could before hitting the ice pack and then letting 3 of his officers off to make their way by foot to the relief of the people at Point Barrow. Captain Tuttle realized that he might not be able to get any closer than 1,500 miles, and we're talking about the dead of winter. The orders came down in mid-November of 1897. The orders as well stated that the overland route was to be taken by the 3 officers, and they were to link up with 2 different reindeer herders that were on the Seward Peninsula. There they were to convince these reindeer herders that they should relinquish their reindeer herd and accompany the revenue officers to Point Barrow so that the reindeer would then provide the food for the whalers. This, to me, is rather a interesting concept because there was no guarantee that the herders would agree with this plan. And so it all hinged upon the ability of the revenue cutters to convince these herders to do this task. And I think that's why we were calling this the impossible task. But even once they linked up, they still had 1,200 to 1,500 miles yet to travel to Point Barrow. at temperatures which ranged as low as 60 below zero.
Right. So this is a pretty difficult, well, impossible journey. Not only are they sailing the Bear, the boat, as far north as they can and then stopping, and from there heading overland to help, they have to somehow convince two different individuals to help them with this project by relinquishing their entire herd, helping to herd them over, and then providing food. And so, like, we talked about this a minute ago, Bob, and you mentioned that this whaling fleet of about 300 whalers was in serious peril, but it wasn't just the whalers now that were in peril because they were in the Point Barrow area. And what was the approximate population of Point Barrow at the time?
Well, at that time, actually, it was the Point Barrow station was a little over 100 people, mostly natives and a few whites that had a trading post. And there was one naturalist that was there collecting samples. Some of the buildings that were there were hardly usable. They had to cannibalize some of their buildings to make room for a portion of the whalers that would be needed to be housed there because some of the ships were crushed in the ice. Some of these ships were as far away as 65 miles from Point Barrow. It was too much for the community and for the fleet. It was just too much of a burden. And actually, the fleet was in danger of starvation, as was the people at the Barrow Station.
Right. Once they tried to help, it tripled the size of the town they had. So all of a sudden, their resources were scarce. And now the people living in Barrow were also at danger. So this is a very important mission, not just to save the whalers, but the people of Port Barrow as well. So in this book, it focuses on some of these main players. Do you have a favorite, Bob, from when you read it?
I think each of the three officers and the two herders are probably the prime players in this particular book. But rather than detail how they went about solving this mission and the energies and the routes that they had to take to obtain it, just know that this was successful. Know as well that it should be common knowledge, yet for me, it was not, and possibly for you, it was not either. And one of the reasons for this is that upon the completion of their mission, it was buried in the newspapers because the Spanish-American War had just broken out, and everything at that point was directed to the new war effort. The thing I liked as well about this book, besides the fascinating read and the tremendous photographs that were taken by Dr. McCall, who was the physician and also the cook for this expedition, was that at the end of the book, it gives you kind of a Paul Harvey, and now for the rest of the story, it takes your cast of characters and it gives you a breakout of what these people did for the balance of their careers. It also takes the revenue cutter Bear and gives you its history. The revenue cutter Bear is, of course, important to the Kodiak area as well, especially around 1913 when we were covered in ash. Ellsworth Bertholdt was one of the three officers that were put ashore. He later became the first commandant of the Coast Guard and was the prime fighter among the other services to keep the Coast Guard as a separate entity from the Navy or the Marine Corps, where political factions wish to put it. I found this book to be, perhaps, if I were to read only one book on Alaska this year, this would be the book. And to find it in the juvenile section is an amazing thing, because the book does say it's for ages 10 and up, but I didn't get it when I was in school, and I should have, and so should you have. This is just fascinating Alaska history.
And just because of a quirk of fate, it got buried historically behind the war. That's fascinating. So tell us a little bit about the future of one of these characters.
Let's talk about the bear itself, because I find the bear to be just a fascinating study. In this chapter of the book, and this starts on page 135 of the book, what happened to them, and it has the bear. From the time that it brought the rescue whaled men back to Seattle until well into the 1900s, the bear continued to patrol Alaska waters, providing aid to mariners and to people living along the coast. When it was put into dry dock in the late 1920s, it appeared that the ship's days at sea were finally over, but destiny still had many new adventures in store for the bear. Purchased by famed explorer Admiral Richard Byrd, the bear carried the Byrd and his party to two historic trips to Antarctic, first in 1933, 34, and then in 1939 to 41. When the United States entered World War II in 1941, the bear was again passed into service patrolling the waters off Greenland and Iceland. Soon after the war ended in 1945, the ship was dry docked once again, this time in Halifax, Nova Scotia. But in 1963, she was purchased by a businessman from Philadelphia who intended to turn her into a floating restaurant. Almost as if in protest of such a degrading ending to such a proud and historic past, the bear's old seams opened up while she was being towed to Philadelphia, and the 89-year-old vessel sunk in 300 feet of water. Despite lengthy underwater search, headed by the man who had discovered the remains of the famous Civil War ironclad, the Monitor, the bear was never found. She still lies in that watery grave. Former Dean of the Coast Guard Academy, David Sandler, has stated, perhaps a fitting place for one so grand a seagoing history.
That is fascinating. So again, for people looking for this book, right now you're going to find it at the Kodiak Public Library in the Young Adult section, but very soon, hopefully we will have another copy available for you in the Alaskana Room. And again, if you're interested, the title of this book is The Impossible Rescue: The True Story of an Amazing Arctic Adventure by Martin W. Sandler. Thanks, Bob, for coming in.
Thank you.
We've got time today on our show to give you another book review, so here's Leanne for you.
Hi, this is Leanne Schmelzbach, and I'm here to talk about not just one book, but a full series that I have loved since I was a child, and that is Lewis Lowry's series, The Giver, published in 1993, Gathering Blue, published in 2000, The Messenger, published in 2004, and The Sun, published in 2012. This series is just amazing to me because it started off with The Giver. The Giver is one of the most popular books. It's won several awards. Many people have read it when they were in middle school or in high school. It's a fantastic example of a dystopia, a future projection of the world where someone realizes that something is very wrong and then sets out to try to change the world for the better. And The Giver also, of course, in the last couple of years has been turned into a fantastic film. It's not exactly like the book, but it's close enough. And as an English teacher, that's very important to me, that the films I show that are connected to the books are close enough that if I show a film, my students won't go, "What? That was terrible. It had nothing to do with the book." Or they'll watch the film and try to replace it with the book. There's enough ties between the book and the film that the storyline is really fun. My students, when they see the film, they understand the character better in a more holistic way, but they understand the difference between the details and why the details of the book are so important to understand so that they have more depth when they watch the film. The main character in The Giver, of course, is Jonas, and he lives in a world where everything is the same. Every person's raised the same. Every person has a way that they are given their job. Every person's expected at different levels and different ages to be able to perform specific tasks. And Jonas is special because Jonas has a gift where he can see beyond. And as you read the book, you come to understand that beyond does not mean he can see into the future. No, it means that he has a connection where he can see color, he can see glimpses into the future, but also into the past. And then he is given the job of being the giver. And the giver's job is to hold all the memories of humanity, all the emotions of humanity, in order to keep civilization and other people from feeling and seeing and experiencing those things so that civilization can be stable and steady and good for all. Jonas, having been given this task, is overwhelmed like anyone would be. And so his journey into becoming the giver and what he realizes that means about his own society and the action he takes within his society is just fun and fast-paced. When the story ends, it ends in a "did that really happen" kind of a note. And that's part of the reason I like the book too. And then I was surprised because I read Gathering Blue and had no idea that it was connected to The Giver in any way, shape, or form. Gathering Blue is a totally unique story, you know, and seemingly unconnected to The Giver. And it's about a young woman who is blind, but not really, because she's able to find and create color. And then she's able to use those colors to weave these amazing and beautiful tapestries that are glimpses into the future. And her story is just amazing. And it does tie itself to The Giver, but not in a way that you would expect. So you definitely have to read that one. Well, The Messenger was the third book. And again, you have a story about an individual that seemingly is not really connected to either The Giver or Gathering Blue. But as you get into the story, you realize, oh, it is connected. Specific people are referenced, specific gifts are referenced. But it's a book that you could pick up and read as a standalone, just like Gathering Blue, and really enjoy. Lewis Lowry's writing is very descriptive. It's one of those things where she weaves every story, and she weaves them in such a way that the characters' lives really become very vibrant and very real. And as they're tied together, if you've read the other stories, you see the connections. You're like, oh, I understand now how The Messenger is connected to Gathering Blue and to The Giver. But if you've never read The Giver or Gathering Blue, you can still read The Messenger and really, truly enjoy the story as it stands. You know, in The Messenger, of course, The Giver was published in 93, The Gathering Blue in 2000, The Messenger in 2004. And then the last one, The Sun, which is the finale to the series, was published in 2012. And again, it's a standalone book, but if you've read the others, just like if you've read the book and then you watch the movie, you just have this incredible depth of the story and you get to see how beautifully woven this whole series is together as it interplays with each other, but not in an obvious, blatant kind of a way. You don't have a single character that travels through every single story and you meet him every single story, but instead it's almost like the vibrations of that character's life and how they've affected the future and how that has affected the main character in the current story's life. And it's a great series to read, whether you pick it up, you know, and read all four at once, or if you pick up one of the books as a standalone because, you know, it sounds more interesting than the others. Lewis Lowry is just a phenomenal writer, and the Giver series is so worth the time to read. They're incredible. There's so much to share and to talk about. If you have students that are in middle school or in high school, if you are a middle schooler or a high schooler, you'll love this series. There's everything you want in it. There's action, there's love, you'll get angry, you'll cry, and you'll laugh. And it doesn't matter what age you are, anytime you read any one of these books in the series, whether you do it in sequence or out of sequence, standalone, you never read any but one of them, or you read all of them, you'll be able to get something out of every single one right where you are in your life. So I would highly recommend this quadtuplet, I think is the word, series of The Giver, published in 1993, Gathering Blue, published in 2000, The Messenger, published in 2004, and the last in the series, The Sun, 2012, all written by Lewis Lowry. Check them out from your library, or buy them outright, or borrow them from a friend, but these are good books to read.
Thanks, Leanne, for that fantastic book review that I would concur with. The Lois Lowry Giver series is a fantastic series of books to read. I highly recommend to anybody out there that hasn't read it to check it out. I'm going to take a moment now to give you people of Kodiak a little bit of information on what's going on at the Kodiak Public Library Association. We are about ready to have our annual meeting. It's being held March 25th from 9:30 to 11:30 in the morning over at Monk's Rock. We're going to provide our guests with a little breakfast and maybe a presentation about what we've done over 2016 at the KPLA and a little idea of what we've got on our plate for 2017. We're pretty proud of what we've accomplished over the last year, and we want want to share it with you, so it's going to be a fun meeting if you want to come down and check it out. We are also looking for a new board member to join our team next year. So if you have any interest in supporting your Kodiak Public Library by becoming a board member at the Kodiak Public Library Association, I encourage you to reach out to us at KPLA and let us know. You can send us a letter of intention to join the board at our email address, or you can always come to one of our meetings, check it out, and see if it's something that would be a good fit for you. Our email address, again, is kpla.alaska@gmail.com. And for information on when our upcoming meetings are, you can visit our website, www.kodiakpubliclibraryassociation.org. We have all of our upcoming information on there, or you can check the library's calendar of events because they're kind enough to put KPLA meetings on there. Our next meeting will be held March 6th at 6 p.m. in the evening at the craft room of the Kodiak Public Library. That will be our final meeting before the annual meeting that's March 25th from 9:30 to 11:30 in the morning at Monk's Rock. So if you want to be a part of our team, come to either of those meetings, check it out, see what we're about, and maybe drop off a letter of intention. We would love to have you on our team. Now, let's hear from the Kodiak Public Library about what they've been up to over the last week. Here's Katie Baxter.
Hi, this is Katie from Kodiak Public Library with today's segment of Lively Live Chat. I have in the studio two wonderful guests who are very often in the library helping our patrons. We have Caitlin, the Public Access Specialist. Hi, Caitlin.
Hello.
And we also have with us Dave, who is from our Information Technology Department. Hi, Dave.
How are you?
I'm doing real well. It's a treat to have you here sitting with us conversing. You are working behind the scenes, keeping our public computer stations up and running all the time. So today we wanted to bring you into our conversation because we're recognizing that there are some current scams and viruses, as well as some great tips that the library staff can be sharing with our audience so that people are protecting their information as well as their own identity, their own selves online. I know Caitlin and I often talk about how some of the public still think computers are magic. What do you think about that, Caitlin?
I find it very fun when they think that you should just be able to click on something and it pops up and there's no problems or issues and just putter along.
Puttering along, and yet we know that those putters turn into stutters and then dead stops, because actually computers aren't magic. They're devices in the hands of humans. And I've seen some of our patrons make some errors, some quick judgments, maybe some rash decisions when they're online because they're in a hurry, or they're very trusting, or they don't want to ask a question when something unusual pops up on that screen. And we've seen patrons in a hurry think, oh, it'll be okay. This will take care of itself. And I do want to point out that, you know, February through May are particularly busy months here at the library with people using our computer stations. We have folks finalizing travel plans, Dave, just to give you an idea of the type of information people are handling. So travel plans, completing applications, obtaining permits, filling out PFD forms, paying bills, connecting with family members. We're also noticing that people are more involved with interactive games. Are there some interactive games, Caitlin, that folks are using?
On their own computers? Mm-hmm. There's Overwatch, which I know is very, very big. There's XCOM. There's
I've been hearing something about League of Legends.
League of Legends. Mm-hmm. These are all interactive, immersive games, meaning you play with the other people online in a fantasy world that's created around you. And, of course, there's always Minecraft, which is very popular here as well.
And so we've been trying to remind our patrons to use common sense about their personal information. But here's where you come in, Dave, because I'm aware that a couple of libraries around our country this past month were hit with ransomware. So I thought you could share with us what you're noticing about use of public computer stations, what kind of practical tips you think are important for people. And then let's just talk a little bit about this emerging ransomware phenomenon that's hitting not only the United States, but global locations as well.
Well, the ransomware is it's a huge thing now. It's really a malware virus that's really become popular. And I was looking at online today, and one of the original ones has made already $327 million already. So it's a big thing right now.
And Dave, when you say that, are people making actual cash?
Yes. Well, there's basically three types. You have what's called scareware, which is basically a pop-up will come on your computer and say, hey, you have to pay me this amount of money. But it doesn't really do anything to your computer as per se. It's more of a threatening type thing. And you have a second one, which actually will lock your PC and throw up a big warning and say, now you're going to have to pay me so-and-so amount of money to get your PC unlocked. And then the third type is an encrypting type, which will basically go in. You can access your PC, but all your files will be encrypted. And, of course, it'll come up with a pop-up saying you want to decrypt your files.
What does encrypted mean?
Well, basically, it won't allow you access to anything. You won't be able to get access to any of your files. And, of course, most of it, especially not here at the library, but home users will run as an administrator. So it will encrypt everything. So basically, unless you have a backup, you're not getting access to your files. And even if you do pay it, that doesn't guarantee that you're going to get access to all your files. Sometimes it doesn't decrypt all the files. So.
And I was curious to hear you use the phrase pop-up. So when a library patron is using a computer station, will a message pop up that will hook them or entice them, or is phishing happening so that a patron's caught off guard because they're busy doing their work, and then does something pop up that starts the ransomware?
Most of the ransomware is coming in through, you mentioned phishing, which is basically, you get an email, say, from your bank, and it looks like it came from your bank, but it really didn't. And so you click on a link or whatever, and that's when it will hit, and you'll get that big sign popping up and say, hey, your files are encrypted. But a lot of it's coming in through email, and there are some websites, what's called drive-bys. You know, you click on a link in a website, and it'll nab you.
So, how do you keep on top of these things? Are you part of a discussion group? You've got a league of techies that you're calling the bat phone and saying, hey, alert, alert.
No, I do a lot of online reading. I subscribe to a lot of stuff online. So, and, of course, ransomware is right up there at the top.
It is. So what are some of the key things that we as library staff can be reminding our patrons?
Well, I think the biggest thing is that they need to use common sense. It's basically coming down to common sense. If something doesn't look right, it's probably not right. So you get an email that from Prince Abdullah from Nigeria saying he's going to send you $1 million, he's probably not going to send you $1 million. So, I mean, what I say is trust no one, basically the way it comes down to.
And I like what you're saying, because I think we had a question from a patron recently because an odd-looking message was coming from Microsoft. I know there was a time a few years ago where I would be receiving messages from the Microsoft administrator. And that was a red flag to me, because wherever I've worked, the technology administrators are very clear and deliberate in their names when they're sending emails, and also in the subject line. So something that looks official coming from a vendor like Microsoft, Yahoo, I don't know if Yahoo is, I don't want to misspeak, but I think, I like what you're saying, we have to use our common sense and recognize when someone's sounding too friendly, and they're going to be our best buddy and set us up with our escape fund, or if they are too generic, not specific enough. So have you noticed anything, Caitlin?
I know I have gotten personally a phone call from a random number who asked if, well, he did not ask. He said, I'm calling to help you fix your own PC. So you should go to your PC and I can help you fix what's on it. And at this time, I did not have a personal PC. I had a laptop. So I was very confused by his question. And I realized that he is not calling me to fix my laptop. He's calling me to get access to my laptop so he can either do a ransomware scam or he can access my information and get personal information from me. And one of, I guess, the tip I would share myself is that most of these computer companies are not going to call you to help you fix your computer. You have to call them to help fix your computer if there's a problem with it.
Excellent. Anything to add to that, Dave?
No, that's a big scam. You get a lot of Microsoft people calling from Microsoft. And, you know, you have a virus on your computer. You need access to it.
And that's by way of an example. We can all keep our eye out for the different company names. Yeah, I think that's a really important thing to bring up here in Kodiak. Yeah,
and,
Dave.
And you were talking about the emails. You know, a lot of times with the emails, too, if you really look at them, there's a lot of misspellings on them. You have misspellings. And if it has a link, you can take your little mouse pointer and point on top of it. Don't click it. Just point on top. And it has an address. And if the address doesn't match, usually there's a company name in there somewhere. If it's something weird, you know then it's not a legit email.
So I love that tip. Think, hover, don't click, think again, and beware ransomware.
Right.
So I think that wraps up our lively live chat for today, unless there's any final tip. I know I've learned a lot about this latest phenomenon with malware, and we look forward to seeing people at our public library computer stations. Lots of great work is being done there by patrons. These computers are wonderful tools that make work seem like magic. But again, you're in charge. You're in the driver's seat. So with that, thanks, Dave.
You're welcome. It's fun.
Caitlin?
Thank you.
See you at the library.
Yeah, see you there.
Thanks, everyone. Have a great day.
Thanks again, Caitlin, Dave, and Katie Baxter for that update. Computer safety is very important in this day and age, and we all have to remember to stay vigilant about what we're opening on our computers. Well, I'm just about ready to wrap up another episode of Dog-Eared Reads, but before I leave, I want to remind you that February is Love of Reading Month, so get out there and read something you love. And if you're looking to read about love, the Kodiak Public Library Association is selling bundles of romance books for $1 a bundle at the Kodiak Public Library. You'll find our special February book display cart right next to where you always find books on sale at the Kodiak Public Library in that main foyer. When you walk in the front door to the library, it's straight ahead and to your left. There's a red cart that says Love of Reading, and we've got some of your top romance authors there. There's Diana Palmer, Debbie McComber, Linda Lael Miller, Joanna Lindsay, and many more I can't think of right now. So stop on down if you know of any of these authors. If you read romance at all, this is the perfect time to get multiple books for $1. It's such a great deal. Stop down by the Kodiak Public Library and check that out. Well, that's our show for today. I want to say thank you to everybody that tunes in to listen to Dog-Eared Reads, Fetching Books and Tales by the Kodiak Public Library Association. I'm Athenia, chair of the KPLA, host and producer of this show, and the one wishing you another month of happy reading. We'll see you again March 14th at 9 p.m. here on KODK 90.7.
Everything be great and everything be good if everybody gave like everybody could. Sweetest little bookworm. The sexiest librarian. Take off those glasses and let down your headphones. Take off those glasses and let down your headphones.
simple little beauty. Heaven in your breath, the simplest of pleasures, the